Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
The following podcast has some fruity language. Sorry, my bad. So take care of who's listening around you. Kia ora tātou katoa. This is me, Anika Moa, and this is my podcast. It's personal, where I get to talk to very, very, very interesting people who blow my mind.
It was emotional for about 10 minutes and we're all there snot blowing out and tears and stuff, and then Mum was like, right, okay, that's it, no more sulking, like, we know what it is now, we'll get to hospital, we'll learn about it, but we don't use it as an excuse, we don't piss and moan about it.
So like me, Sophie Devine has type 1 diabetes. Unlike me, she's an elite athlete. She's captain of the White Ferns, and we chat about leadership, mental health and the dreaded diabetes. I've got heaps of questions for you. We can talk about whatever you want as well. If you want to promote it, promote your new album coming out.
Oh my gosh. I have got no vocal ability whatsoever.
Do you reckon though?
Honestly, I'm shit, like worse than shit actually.
What about with all your when you have changing room sing-alongs, do you
and I just don't sing because I'm that bad that I would bring everyone else down, so yeah, I get banned from singing.
I used to play rugby for Canterbury. I used to always bring my guitar in the room and try and cheer everyone up if we lost. We never lost a game though, so I guess I didn't do that.
That's a good thing, but also...
We never lost a game. How mental is that?
For how long?
I played schoolgirls for 4 years, and then I chose music over rugby because I'm a... I just wanted to smoke weed, basically, and play my guitar. Can't smoke weed when you're a professional sports player, can you?
No, you can't. You can't, unfortunately.
You get drug tested, eh?
Yeah, quite a bit, actually, which is a bit weird when you really think about it.
Well, you can't do drugs if you play professional sports. You can't do drugs if you drive a forklift.
Well, no, I meant more the actual process of someone watches you wee. That sort of where it's a bit weird.
Oh, do they actually watch you wee?
Oh, God, yes. So you have to pull your top up and your pants around your ankles.
So they see you minge?
100%. Some people get right up in there and I'm like, whoa, like, what else are you trying to see, sister?
It's always a woman, eh, that watches your wee. Maybe I should get that job. Imagine that, eh? Sophie, drop your decks. Drop your decks, Sophie. Yeah. Okay, we're starting. I think we've already started, actually. Okay, so firstly, where did you grow up and did you have quite a sporty upbringing?
Yep, so I grew up in a little suburb north of Wellington called Tawa.
Oh, yeah.
There's not much to do there. I think Lynn of Tawa's probably made it famous for women's prison at one end and the mental hospital at the other end. So I think we've got a bit more. We've got a Dress Mart now, the Outlet City, which
I've
really
been there.
Boosted up. But, yeah, it was pretty much just every sport under the sun, like most Kiwi kids. I just, would be out as soon as the sun was up, playing sport, have to go to school, come back, be playing any sort of sport I can get. And then, I guess for me, it's been lucky enough to turn that into my job these days.
And do you have siblings that you played sports with? And were you, from a young age, quite competitive with all your sports? Hockey, cricket, was it softball, touch rugby, all of that as well?
All of that. I was, a little psycho. Like, I just love getting stuck into it. And, from a very young age, probably a little bit too competitive for some kids. We're just there to sort of run around and stuff. Like, I remember, wouldn't have been older than 7 or 8, and me and one of my mates had figured out pretty early playing hockey on the grass. One of us would go in where all the kids would swarm around the ball and the other one would just wait by the goal. We'd get the ball, whack it up to the top, score goals. We'd be scoring 10, 15 goals every weekend sort of thing, which...
Were you the centre and was she the forward?
Well, he was because it was mixed at
that stage. Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was great. And then we'd switch around next week so I'd get turns at scoring all the goals. So, yeah, always been competitive. I've got two sisters and a brother, probably more so with my brother.
Yeah.
It was certainly, yeah, probably I followed him around, I guess, like a little dog growing up, things like that, playing all sports, whether it was rugby, yeah.
Bull rush,
kick and anything.
Back. Do you remember kick and back?
No, is that force back?
Oh, is it? You know, when you get a rugby ball and you kick it and you force them, yeah, force back. Yeah. Did you play that?
Yeah, we did.
God,
so
I played that.
In Wellington, you had to get the wind behind you because otherwise you're screwed.
True. I used to play hockey, and I think hockey is probably the most aggressive sport ever. But I come from a poor area in Christchurch and I could never afford shin pads. So I was constantly coming home with like bruises on my shins I was a psycho too. It was never lose. Never lose. Oh. If you lose, you're a loser.
Yeah, exactly that. I remember we were the same. Like if you didn't have shin pads, we used to actually get magazines and just put them down our socks. I don't think that really did anything. But yeah, it is. You can be sort of subtly psycho as well in hockey, which I think is quite smart. You know, you can jab people with the stick and accidentally hook your stick around someone's foot and trip them up, you know. Not that I'm suggesting that you do that. But.
You're not that kind of player though, right? You're not the vindictive cricket player where you, I don't know, what do? Tamper with the ball and do the ball. How do you ball tamper? What do you do to ball tamper?
It's more you... like scratch it or bite it or, I mean, I don't know why you bite a cricket ball, but, you know, yeah, scratch it on the ground, whatever. There's a whole heap of sandpaper if you're Australian. That seems to be a big thing for them.
So weird. Australians are quite renowned cheats though, aren't they?
They are, especially in cricket. They are.
not in women's cricket though, right?
No, not the women's team. The women's team's great. Well, they're great, but they win everything, so everyone hates them. But apart from that...
So you grew up in Tawa, you're competitive, you're sporty, and then you end up in the women's cricket team. I have to look down and see what it's called because there's like black ferns, silver ferns, da-da-da ferns. But I'm like, oh, white ferns.
White ferns, yes.
You make the team in 2006?
Yep.
How did it feel... after doing all that mahi, all that work, to then make the New Zealand team?
I don't think it really hit me, to be honest. I think because I was so young and I just love playing, to me that it was just almost seemed like the next step for me was to try and make rep teams, and then obviously getting the phone call. I still remember it as clear as day, being in it at high school actually, and getting the phone call, which, I mean, you're not supposed to have your phones in class, but stuff that, you know, and I remember leaving and having the phone call with the coach at the time, and, like, school was a write-off after that. I remember just running home being, like, whoa, like, shouting and hollering and stuff like that. So, it's an incredible honour. Like, it's real cliche and stuff like that, but it's honestly, like, the best feeling ever to have that recognition and the opportunity to represent. And that's what I still think about these days. It's like all the people that have helped me get to this point is unbelievable, do you know what I mean? And I would be no way near here if it wasn't for coaches, you know, mum and dad, brothers and sisters, like umpires, scorers. Like there's so many people that have impacted me and have allowed me to end up where I am now. So sort of sometimes a nice reminder to think that it hasn't just been me. It's been this whole huge tribe of people have helped me get to where I am.
But do you think, you know, you worked hard for it and you believed in yourself and you have that competitive streak or edge, so it says a lot about you as a person to strive to achieve the best you can?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, even from earlier, like I wanted to be an All Black. I mean, I didn't realise that there was Black Ferns or New Zealand women's rugby team. Yeah. But here I was thinking, yeah, I'm going to break into the All Blacks alongside Jonah Lomu. But, for me, there was no other option. I was going to play sport for New Zealand. I didn't care what sport it was or whatever. That was just it. Like, I couldn't see myself doing anything else. So, I think it's always just been in my head from a very young age that this is what I want to do. And, yeah.
So did you finish school?
Yep, finished school and finished university, which I don't know how sometimes, but was really lucky to be supported. It used to be called the Prime Minister's Scholarship, which used to help athletes get through university. So I did that straight away because if I had to do it now, I would be hopeless.
Yeah, well, it's too much work, isn't it?
Well, listening and stuff like that, I'm not very good at that.
Why is that?
I'm pretty hyper. Like, I struggle to sit still and things like that, and just being outside, I always want to sort of just be going, doing things, and sitting down for long periods of time is not my jam.
Yeah, but is it hard to sit down for an interview?
Depends how good the interview is, to be honest. You know, if it's engaging and stuff like that. So
if I see you squirming. Well, I haven't had anyone bugger off yet, so you could be a first. So you go on for how many years? For like 14 years, and then you become the captain of the team, right? How do you get to become the captain? What do you need? What traits and qualities do you need to become the captain of the White Ferns?
Oh, honestly, I had no intention of being the captain. I think, as you've seen, I was playing for 14 odd years and was happily just a member of the side, and then a few things probably changed within our environment. Susie Bates earlier had stepped down as captain, and Amy Satterthwaite went on maternity leave. And so, I guess it was a conversation between the coaches at the time and New Zealand Cricket, and I just felt like I could offer something. I guess being in the group for so long, wanted to lead, had always been interested in sort of the captaincy side of things with cricket. So it was sort of a combination of things, and I'm still here doing it now, so hopefully I'm doing something right, or people are just too scared to get rid of me, which is great.
Could be that. Do you think you are a good captain? Do you feel like you've led the team well? And do you, if you have losses, do you feel like it's all on you?
Yeah, there's some really great questions in that. I'd like to think I do a good job, but I think the great thing about, it's not just sport and cricket, it's, there's always something to learn. You can always get better. There's always things that you feel that you can grow and evolve and develop, which I think is really exciting for me. And I think being from New Zealand and being so fortunate to be surrounded by so many incredible female sports people, I look at the Black Ferns Sevens, the Black Ferns, the Silver Ferns, like there's so many incredible wahine out there that are just leading the way that I'm like, shit, yeah, I want to see what they do, how they do it, how they run their environment, their culture. So for me, it's really exciting to be just involved and have that opportunity to influence this group. Losses suck. Like, I hate losing. I hate it. So it's always hard, and especially with captaincy, you do feel that extra sense of responsibility, and there's times where you're sitting in your room and a million different thoughts, and you're replaying the game ball by ball, which cricket can be a bloody long game sometimes, so you're sort of having to replay it a fair bit. But I think that's something that I've learned probably as captain over the last couple of years, is you can't dwell on it, because cricket's a pretty shitty sport like that. That there's going to be more crap times, low times, than there is good times, but it's those good times that keep you hooked on it and wanting you to keep playing. So it's getting that balance right in terms of you are the captain and you are the leader, but you're also making sure that you keep looking forward and keeping the group positive and moving forward.
Is it nice to be a mentor for the younger players joining the team?
Yeah, I think it's pretty crazy. Like, we've got a couple of, 19, 20-year-olds. To think back, like, that used to be me, and I guess it's quite cool for me to be able to go, like, shit, okay, well, what was I thinking at that time? Like, well, one, I never spoke because I was too shit scared to, so I just sat in the corner, and if someone said clean my shoes, I'd do it, with a toothbrush sort of thing. So it's cool to sort of see how the environment and the groups sort of evolved and change over time, but also just to see this young group of players coming through and the the confidence they've got, but also, you know, to hopefully share my knowledge. I've been lucky to play a fair bit of cricket around the world, to just sort of, let's say, take a dump on them with all my knowledge, but it's probably not the right.
I like that analogy.
But yeah, to be able to share some of that stuff, because at the end of the day, yeah, I just want women's cricket to keep getting better and to try and bring more people to come and watch it, because, you know, I've been really lucky to have a pretty incredible career in this sport.
When I played rugby, there was a lot of bitchiness. There was a lot of, you know how, it's funny because women are real mind game players. Well, not all women, but, you know, when I was playing rugby, you'd be in the ruck and someone would be like, you useless bitch. Yeah, you're going to get rucked. So, you know, like, it was real rough and it was quite, because I was a tiny wee thing. I used to get, what's that thing when you run towards someone?
Oh, clothesline.
Yeah, I used to get clotheslined. I used to get my hair pulled. That's why I cut my hair. And is there bitchiness or I don't know, like, is there anything like that in cricket, in women's cricket?
Not really. It's probably changed again. Like, I'll never forget. So I must have been maybe 11 or 12 at the time, and I got invited to bowl at the Wellington Blaze, at the Wellington women's cricket team. And obviously really young, I was absolutely shitting my pants. Like, oh, my gosh, this is so exciting. Like, these are, you know, the best players in the country. And I accidentally bowled a bouncer, which is where you pitch it short and it goes at someone's head. I completely accident bowled it, and this lady fucking threw down her bat and said, you little C-bomb, you fucking do that again, I'm going to fuck it. And I was just, like, stood there. And I remember getting in the car with Mum afterwards, and I was like, Mum, what's... And she was like, oh, don't you ever say that word again. Who said that? I was like, oh, well, the lady I was bowling against called me it. And she was like, what? So, you know what I mean? Like, it's just changed so much now from, I think, earlier in my career. There was just a real hard streak, which I certainly think you still need. You need that rough edge and that, you know, but there's that balance too, because getting called a C-bomb when you're 11 years old from a woman, maybe not be as inspiring, but, you know, in the same sense, she became one of my best mates and still to this day, you know what I mean, is the most loyal and caring person. So, in terms of bitchiness, probably not so much. I don't think so. You get the odd person that you're always going to clash with, and I'm all for it, as long as it sort of stays on the field and it's nothing personal and horrible. Like, I'm all for a bit of banter and a bit of joking around.
Yeah.
Cricket's, you need something, because cricket can be boring. Like, let's be honest, 6 hours standing around can be pretty boring. So you've got to have a bit of banter and a bit of fun sometimes.
Okay, so we've talked about cricket, which is your passion and your drive. You're a professional cricket player. And you've also got type 1 diabetes,
yes.
Which is, I it's crazy, because I also have type 1 diabetes, and I know what it takes to get past the first hour of the morning. You know, you have to take your Jaggers, you have to take... How old were you when you were diagnosed?
So I was 15 when I was diagnosed. I had all the classic symptoms at the time. So I lost a heap of weight. I was eating heaps. I was sleeping heaps. I was going toilet heaps. All classic symptoms. And then I remember saying to my mum, I was like, I think something's wrong. Like, I'm going to the toilet. And she's like, oh, you'll be fine. It's just a bladder infection. Piss it out. You'll be fine. And we sort of left it another
week.
Good old
mums.
Or so.
Piss it out, babe. Piss it out.
Mum. You'll be right. But then I remember going into school one day, walking into the classroom, and I couldn't see the whiteboard. Everything was sort of fuzzy. And I was like, that's a bit weird. So I remember getting home and being like, Mum, like, I can't see the whiteboard. And she's like, oh, fine, I guess I'll take you to the bloody doctors.
Your mum sounds real supportive.
Well, it was sort of a little bit sad afterwards. So, yeah, you know, within half an hour of the doctors, you know, doing the test and the urine test and stuff, they're like, yeah, we're pretty sure you've got diabetes.
Did you know?
To send you to hospital,
yeah.
Pretty much.
For DKA?
No, I was actually all right. I was actually okay considering some of the stories I've heard, but I do. I remember sitting in the car with Mum, and we both just bawling our eyes out, just like crying, and Mum was obviously really apologetic. She's like, I'm sorry, I should have listened, or I should have known, or
yeah, but no one knows. Yeah. Like, no one really knows anything about type 1.
Nah.
So it
was emotional for about 10 minutes, and we're all there, snot blowing out and tears and stuff. And then Mum was like, right, okay, that's it. No more sulking. Like, we know what it is now. We get to hospital, we'll learn about it, but we don't use it as an excuse. We don't piss and moan about it. Let's crack on. And literally from that point, it was okay, right, let's get on with it sort of thing.
But being a teenager, you love your lollies, you love your burgers, you love your carbs. And as a diabetic type 1, you actually have to carb count and you can't eat much sugar. How does that, what was that like for you?
That was honestly, I think that was probably the first question I asked. I was like, can I still have ice cream? Can I still have lollies? And they're like, yeah, you can, but you've just obviously, got to make sure that you inject the right amount and know how much sugar and carbs is in it sort of thing. So that was my biggest concern, that lollies and sugar and ice cream, and then shit, can I actually still play sport? I thought, again, I had no clue what it means. So I was like, well, I'm never playing sport again. That's me done sort of thing. Yeah. So I was super lucky at Wellington Hospital, the team we had there with the, you know, the endocrinologists, the diabetes nurses and educators and stuff, literally stayed in for 24 hours and I was back out the next day. And then a couple of weeks later, I was playing in a underage hockey tournament in Oamaru, actually.
Yeah.
And literally on the phone every morning to our diabetes nurse being like, this is my sugars, this is what I've eaten, how much do I need to inject? And he was amazing, like 24 hours a day available to make sure that I could, you know, get back to normal, because I was so worried that, yeah, I couldn't eat lollies, I couldn't play sport, everything was going to be crap. But I think that really helped.
It's a crash course, and literally you have to do a course. I haven't done that course yet, though, because I'm too I'm naughty. I remember the year that I had all the symptoms for diabetes, and I was running every day and running half marathons and running. But I remember doing the Queenstown half, and I was so, my mouth was so dry, and I kept having to stop for wheeze. And every single stop, I had to have the Coca-Cola. Like, I was just like, I need something sugary. And what I didn't realise is that my body was in DKA, and I don't even know how I finished that 21 Ks. Like, I dragged my sick body over the finishing line. And it was, I look back at that moment and think, fuck, I was stubborn. Fuck, my mind was, I had a strong mind because my body was telling me I'm done. But my mind was like, fuck you, bitch. These legs are going to move and I'm going to finish this because I'm stubborn and I want to achieve.
Yeah.
And then I got diagnosed and I gave up running because I am too scared to run in case I get a low, in case I get a high.
Really?
Yes. But I'm still learning. I'm still in the first 2 years of it. What advice would you give to people who are recently diagnosed?
Oh, yeah, shit, there's a few, but I think something that really stuck out for me was that every diabetic's different. How you react to different foods, what insulin's going to do to your body, how exercise is going to change your sugars or how much insulin you take, it's going to be completely different to mine, and it could be different day on day. Like, I am so lucky in the White Ferns, I've got Jess Kerr, who's also a type 1 diabetic, so we literally talk in like our secret language, like, oh my gosh, my blood sugar levels, I need to inject this much, and this is how much carbs, and oh, I need to change my needles and stuff.
Atlantis and CGM and.
Yeah. But it's so nice just to be able to talk to someone else who has it, knows what it's, you know, knows what you're going through. That's a big thing for me is, being able to talk about it with someone, to find someone that you can vent, because it can be so fucking frustrating.
Yeah.
And I think that even for me, you know, people say, oh, do you have your diabetes under control? And I'm like, well, what does that even mean? Like, I think I do. And then there's days where I don't go below 10. And I'm like, well, what do you want me to do? Like, I lie in bed and not do anything and, do you know what I mean, not eat or whatever. There's times where I get really frustrated with that, where sometimes I'm just like, I actually don't have a fucking clue what my diabetes is doing. Like, I could do exactly the same thing, eat the same, inject the same, exercise, everything's exactly the same, but my sugars are like
through the roof,
and I'm just going to go like that, and you feel like shit, and it's just
So for people who don't know the sugars, we should, what's the control range? It's between 5 and 8 or 5 and 10.
Well, I mean, again, that's sort of up for interpretation. 4 to 8, 5 to 8, 5 to 10. That's what I guess normal people, their sugars remain between, but it's just a constant juggle, as you know. It's a constant juggle to try and maintain that. And if you are, it's like, woohoo, I'm great. And then when you're not, you're sort of like, oh, shit. I've not failed, but it sucks. You're sort of like, oh, okay, I haven't quite got this right yet.
You've had a few or one or two hypos on the pitch when you've been playing. Yeah. How do you take yourself off the field, sugar up, wait a while, or are you just like, oh, well, get on with it?
Again, I probably learned the hard way. I was a little bit like you in terms of being stubborn, and I was like, nah, I'm not fucking coming off. I'll be fine. And then I was like, holy shit. Yeah, I was like, I can see three cricket balls. I'm fucked here if this comes towards me, sort of thing. I was like, I'll just shove jelly beans and a scoffed banana. And I was like, yep, no, it's fine. Got back out there and just kept going low. I was like, okay, right.
Could have been the heat.
Well, it could have been anything, do you know what I mean? So at that stage, I was like, okay, shit, I actually need to step off the field now and actually take some time and let the sugars do its thing, let the carbs sort of kick in and stuff like that. Whereas now I'm probably a little bit older and smarter to be like, yep, I'm a little bit low. I'll just sit off for 5-10 minutes, have a banana, have some jelly beans, have a drink of water, let that kick in and then back out there.
Well, it's a 6-hour game, so you've got time.
You do have time. So,
do you feel like sorry for yourself with this autoimmune disease? Like, have you had days where you're like, oh, poor me, you know, as we all do, and why me?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. We were actually saying the other day, me and Jess were like, fuck, I wish someone else could just have diabetes for the day. Like, you just get sick of it, and there's times where you just get fed up that you want a break from it. That's pretty much the best way to describe it. You just want to break up with diabetes and have a couple of days where you're not having to inject, or you're not having to check your sugars, or be days wary off. Of what you're
There's no days off. It's a 24/7 thing that you have to think about constantly, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's where I probably try and give myself a bit of kick up the bum, where I'm like, actually, I can still see, I can still hear, I've still got my arms, my legs, I can still move around, I can still be active. You know, there's people that are in a lot worse position than I am, so be grateful. But there's also times where you just want to sit in your grumpiness and sulk and piss and moan and things like that. I think that's only natural, so it's about being okay with it at times.
When I feel like I'm grumpy with it, I go and eat an ice cream without insulining.
Yeah, I'm like, screw you,
I'm like, screw you, insulin. Ha ha, didn't insulin. Oh god, I'm getting hot. And then it's like kicks your ass a couple of hours later. How do you think diabetes has affected your mental health?
That's a great question. I think it's almost to the point that we just said before, that there's no days off. And that's sometimes really hard, is when you need a break or you are trying to have some downtime or whatever, you still got to manage that. It doesn't go anywhere. You still got to test. You still got to inject. Like, that's following you everywhere you go. So, I think certainly it's sometimes when I've had low patches or, you know, dark times, that's just another thing that has, you know, weighs you down as well. Because I've still got diabetes. It's still kicking my ass. It's still there. It's not going anywhere. So at times it can certainly be a bit of a downer. But, you know, at the same time, it is. It's that reminder for me that I can still move around. I can still be active. I get to still play cricket and play sport.
Still got your feet. Mate, so.
Well, exactly. At this stage.
At this stage, yep.
Yep, they might be gone in 20 years' time, but
that's
all right.
What it's famous for, eh? It stops the blood flow to your limbs, and then you don't have hands or feet. And
that was actually one thing that really – it actually upset me a little bit when I was first diagnosed, is how – I don't know the word for it, but like how over the top they're like, yeah, you're probably going to lose your feet and you're going to go blind and your kidney's going to crap out and you're going to have to be on dialysis. And I was like, holy shit, like, okay, like, I didn't know any better. So I was like, well, there go my feet, there goes my feeling and the sensation of my hands. I'm going to be blind by the time I'm 30. So at times I think they can really, put a real negative lens on it. I know you need to be
vigilant and aware.
Vigilant, honest, and be aware of the complications and the risks associated with it. But there were times where it freaked the shit out of me because I was like, holy hell, like, that's a lot to comprehend as a 16-year-old, that you don't fucking look after yourself, you're going to lose your legs. It's just like, whoa, okay. Like, rather than being, you take good care of yourself, you keep exercising, you eat well, there's no reason why you shouldn't have, you know, a long, healthy life. Rather, it was, you're probably going to die, your kidney's going to crap out. It's just sort of quite confronting.
I've got four kids, and it's actually a really good, I find it funny because I've got diabetes and they know everything there is to know about carb counting and sugar and how bad it is for you. And I always go, you might get diabetes if you eat too much chocolate. And they are scared. I'm like, yes, eat these broccolis. Like, it's actually a good parenting technique.
It's got to have some perks, doesn't it?
Oh, well, that's the only perk, pretty much. Oh, people feel sorry for you sometimes too. You had a moment, 2021, where you had to take a break from cricket. What was the trigger for that?
Probably goes back to being stubborn and thinking that I was okay. Having been on the road for so long, especially with all the COVID stuff as well. Like, COVID was a crap time for everyone.
Yeah.
No doubt about that, but I guess the time that we spent locked up in hotel rooms, and I don't want to downplay that other people weren't, you know, struggling and it was a shit for everyone, but, you know, our environment changed so much being literally locked in your room for long periods of time. I think I did six MIQs.
Wow.
And that was like, I don't wish anyone to do one, let alone six. So having spent so many time alone by myself in an environment where you can't leave your room was really hard for me, especially wanting to be outside so much and, you know, isolated. That was probably a bit of a tipping point for me, was having to go through so many of those in a pretty short period of time, and just being overloaded and overcooked. And for so long, I was like, no, I'm okay. And I just got to a point where I was like, I'm not okay. And if I don't stop now and step back, you know, I'm not going to be any use to anyone, sort of thing. So really hard decision for me to step away from cricket, because it's all I've ever done, it's all I've ever wanted to do.
Yeah.
But it got to a point where I needed to, because I was nowhere, and I wasn't.
What was going through your head? Were you having panic attacks? Did you feel depressed? Were you just struggling with your mind?
Yeah. So I've obviously been diagnosed with depression, well, previously, and, you know, had been managing it with antidepressants and stuff like that and been going all right. And then obviously through COVID and stuff like that, probably, yeah, just sort of those things came back. And I guess it's not funny, but when you talk about depression and now people talk about the black dog or the black cloud and things like that, that it's always sort of looming, that was just happening again. I just felt that something was always there on my shoulder, that it's just something you can't shake, that you're just low mood, you're depressed. I hated being around people, really anxious in big groups or with people or in situations that I wasn't prepared for. So, you know, if I bumped into someone that I hadn't planned on, or someone asked me to speak at a cricket event or something, it freaked me out, and certainly have had my fair share of panic attacks and things like that. So, you know, with all that combined, I knew that the best thing for me was to remove myself from that environment and just literally say, right, I just need to focus on myself here and getting into good routines and things like that. So stepping away was bloody hard, but necessary.
Did you think that, do you think that a way to help with your depression, panic attacks, anxiety, all those things, is to have a routine? Because no one's ever not healing, right? So you're going to be 80 and you're still healing. But because I've got depression at the moment, I've never felt this way before, because I've always just been a go, get diagnosed, get depression, have panic attacks, anxiety, all that stuff. Everything that you're mentioning is stuff that I'm going through now. So I find it really interesting, because usually I wouldn't talk about it, but I need to, because if I don't, those dark thoughts are really, they sit right here. When you're in public, you try to, I'm digressing here, but you try to hide it, but you just mask. Everyone masks, but I don't do that anymore. So I just tell everyone I'm depressed. I'm depressed. Yeah. I'm sad. And what? How am I getting through it? I'm getting 10 hours of sleep a night.
Yeah.
Is that what you were doing with your routine? Were you just keeping it simple, stripping everything back?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is. It's amazing that you say that around talking about it, because I was exactly the same. I didn't know how to talk about it, and I didn't want people to be like, I don't know how to be around you now. And that was something I really struggled with, is not to anyone's fault, but people sometimes don't know how to behave around it. If someone says, I'm depressed, people are like, oh, fuck, okay, oh, there, like, it'll be okay, you'll be better soon. And sometimes it's not, and sometimes it's literally just a case of being like, oh, that really sucks for you, but I'm here if you ever need to talk or if you want to go for a coffee. And that's certainly something I've probably taken out of it, is because before this I was like, how can you be depressed? Like, what the fucking even is that? Like, you can't get out of bed? What's wrong with you? That, like, to me, I couldn't comprehend depression and what that meant. And then going through it and still going through it now, it's like, it literally is. There's days where I cannot get out of bed, and I – you know, for me that always wants to be outside doing things, like, that's a huge warning sign that I don't want to see people, I don't want to talk, low mood, grumpy. But, yeah, stripping it back to routines, absolutely. It's sleeping, eating, it's getting out in nature, and whether it's a walk or, you know, just getting outside and moving the body. Yoga was a big one for me during that time, meditation, things like that.
It's funny because if any of my friends go, do you need to talk about it? I'm like, yeah, I do. Come on. Like, I'm really, because I need to understand why, how, what's going on in the brain. What are you feeling? You know, I struggle to get out of bed some days. I love sleeping. I'm just like addicted to it. But I've got four kids. I've got, you know, kids that need to go to school. So that actually helps with my routine. I looked at I stalked you on Instagram the other day, and I saw your bookshelf.
Yeah.
What kind of reader are you? Bill Bryson novels.
Yeah, oh, that must have been Mums or something. That must have somehow sneaked in there. I go through real phases. Obviously, being on the road so much, it's a great way to kill time when you're in airports and planes and things like that. I go through real, like, self-help phases, whereas you can probably tell from my bookcase, it's mostly like, yeah, be a Buddha and meditate and
breathe
and stuff like that. But, yeah, for me, reading's a really good escape when I'm in the mood and can go for it, sort of thing, is, yeah.
Do you like mind-numbing books? You know, I have books that I go to that just numb the mind and just easy read, like The Girl Next Door with the Train on Fire, you know, like all those books.
Yeah, well, Colleen Hoover has been this year, I reckon I got through about 10 of her books.
Same.
Literally. So I was just like, oh, whoa.
Sort it's of just thing, an easy read, such... eh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you read Verity?
Talk about psychos. That was
That was so mental, eh? But it was so cliche that I thought there'd be some sort of twist, but there just wasn't. It just was too cliche.
Yeah, absolutely. But it is. Like, it's such a cool way to do something different for me as well, as, you know, to have some quiet time alone without spending time on the screen. Like, I still suck at that. I spend way too much time.
We all do.
Yeah.
Just own it.
Yeah, I should, absolutely. I know I should be better, but it's also...
If I could, I'd go on Instagram overreading to my children at night.
Really?
I'm just being honest. What else do you do to chill out? Like, what do you, you know, you're such a high-intensity, amazing cricket performer. What do you do that that mellows you out? Like, do you go on dinner dates? Do you do yoga?
Yeah. It's funny you say, like, dinner and things. When I see people go out for these fancy dinners and they get meals that are, like, literally a mouthful, and I'm like, you paid, like, $80 for that, screw that. I'm, you know, just going to go down the road to a pub and get a good steak and mash sort of thing. But golf, I really like golf. It's a really cool mix for me, because it's, you're still outside, you're still walking and stuff, but it's really slow-paced, and it's, you take time, you're out in nature.
It's just like cricket.
Well, exactly. It is. It's very similar to cricket. I mean, I still throw my clubs sometimes when I stuff up and whatnot. But,
do you drink when you play golf?
You can, depending who you play with, absolutely.
make it fun.
But, yeah, and blast some music, although sometimes the old fogies don't like the music blaring, but
old fogies. I haven't heard that in a long time. Old fogies.
Yeah, it's just stuff like that. Just getting out of the cricket environment or the sport environment sometimes is just what you need, because you're in it so much and it can be so just all encompassing. All you do, all you see is cricket or sport, that sometimes you literally just need to go out and do something completely different or something different.
What would you be doing if you weren't a cricket player?
I would love to be a sevens player.
Oh, with Ruby Tui and Portia.
Yeah, I'm like the biggest fangirl of the sevens team.
How would that go with your diabetes?
Yeah, who knows? I don't know. But it would be something that I would be willing to try. I did play rugby a couple of years ago for a club team in Wellington, the Petone Ponies. and I got stuck out on the wing because I was one of the smallest players in the team, which is unusual because I'm fairly big in the cricket sort of circles.
Yeah.
But I was just like, catch the ball and run as fast as you fucking can and don't get caught, sort of thing. You know? But I didn't do that too well. I got caught quite a bit, actually. So
so you stuck with cricket?
I sort of stuck at rugby and came back to cricket.
So, yeah, from quite a still game to never stop running game.
Oh, honest. But I love rugby. I am so obsessed. I'm one of those people that watches and, oh, come on, ref. Oh, why'd you do the pass, kick, run, sort of thing. I'm one of those people that is just obsessed with it.
Why don't you be a rugby player? Train up.
Because they're so good. And I think I'm only good in my head. I'm not actually good in real life. And I don't think that works. I can't just join a team and because I think I'm good in my head.
What's been your best ever game? Just the most elated you've felt. Like, imagine, you know, the All Blacks winning the World Cup, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, oh, it's crazy. Like, early on in my New Zealand career, we went through this phase where we kept making World Cup finals. I mean, we kept losing them. But to get to World Cup finals was just like, this is so cool. Like, you do all that work and you get to a final sort of things. I mean, we shat the bed, but to get there is pretty awesome. And especially, like, for us, the last 10 years, we haven't made it past semis, so or group stage. So, yeah, that's awesome. I mean, there's been a couple of games and some franchise competitions where you've gone really well, and it's nice to do that. But, again, it's so cliche, but I'd so rather the team win than me go really well. It sort of is a bit of an empty feeling. It's a funny one, cricket. Like, say I score 100 runs but the team loses, you sort of, it's like, oh, well, this is shit.
No, but you've achieved a century.
That's great, but it's like, but the team's lost, so you're sort of like, oh, yay.
No, you go to the changing sheds going, yeah, I'm the bomb, yep. I'm the bomb. Yep. And everyone's like, oh, good on you, bitch.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a personal question. Do you believe in love at first sight?
No.
Oh, shit. Interview over. No. No.
Do you?
I used to.
Yeah.
I used to. I have a deep, I like to have a deeper understanding of a human.
Mm.
2 weeks after I've had sex with them. No. I'm a hoe. I don't wait. I don't wait with people. I've got a partner and I don't wait. I'm just like, let's get to the sex now. Come on, let's do it. And then I'll get to know you.
Yeah. What's the point in waiting? That sounds great.
Yeah. So you don't believe in love at first sight. Do you believe in soulmates?
Nah. I haven't thought about that. I think when I was younger, I did. I think I liked the idea of it, that, you know, there's a soulmate out there for you and you'll find the one. And it's like, well, I've had four ones. And do you know what I mean? It's like,
if you had four ones,
it obviously doesn't work. But I think it's nice to sort of have that illusion or that dream of something like that. But at the end of the day, it's a connection to a person. That's the most important thing.
Man, that was such a good kōrero. Thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to me.
Thank you as well for sharing around your story too with depression and things like that. I think it's so important that we just open and honest about it. There's so many Kiwis out there that are battling demons that they're just too scared to share. So thank you for
sharing. I know, and I'm right in the middle of mine too. People don't usually talk about it until after they're better. And I'm like, I mean, I like tonguey. I'm like, and then I'm like, I'm such a drama queen. You're amazing. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks heaps, guys.
Thank you.
See ya.
Ka kite. Thanks so much for listening to It's Personal with me, Anika Moa. Cheers. A huge mihi to Sophie Devine for taking time out of her busy training schedule to speak with us. Kia ora, sis. Also to the team that helps make this happen, Charlotte Purdy and Vanessa Hawken from Rogue Productions, Tim Watkin and Liz Garten from RNZ, and our audio engineers Blair Stagpool and Adrian Holley. Cole Easton-Farrelly is a video editor, and thanks to Jane Joyce for graphics and Brianna Juritich for production support. It's Personal with Anika Moa is available on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Don't forget to follow so you don't miss an episode.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.